A few years back, we spoke to the authors of a book aimed at young people called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. That book pointed out the faults in the Constitution with stories and examples from current and historical events. An updated edition of the book came out last year in paperback, and now there is Fault Lines in the Constitution, the graphic novel, written by Cynthia Levinson, a writer of nonfiction for young readers, and Sandy Levinson, a professor of law at the University of Texas in Austin. And now there's a new member of the creative team, illustrator Ali Schwed. I asked Cynthia and Sandy what they hoped this edition of the book will accomplish that the others did not.
Well, to present the stories visually in cartoon fashion, there's also less text, so it kind of cuts to the chase in some ways. The illustrator, Ali Schwed, has a wonderfully wry sense of humor, you know, for different kinds of readers, different kinds of learners. So it's a whole new approach that we're thrilled about.
Was there a specific age group you were looking for, maybe a little younger than the others?
That's actually a wonderful question, because I am more than old enough to remember when comic books were for kids. And we had written Fault Lines for teenagers. And even though the term now is graphic novels, I think we assumed that the audience would be teenagers or perhaps even younger. But Macmillan is in fact marketing it as an adult book because, as you may well know, graphic novels have now become for everybody.
As you put this together, of course, there's a little bit of updating done in here. What modern events did you choose?
Well, certainly immigration. Every chapter begins with a story, and one of the chapters starts with a story about a dreamer. That is certainly a key event. The dreamer event actually introduces the chapter on, what is it, filibusters, I think, Sandy, is that right?
Yep.
And we also have a chapter, believe it or not, on epidemics, which has to do with presidential emergency powers and also habeas corpus, you know, the right of people not to be imprisoned against their will if the government doesn't have a reason to keep them imprisoned. In fact, one person, after reading the chapter on epidemics, and we end that chapter with a statement about how at the first sign of a pandemic, there could be a lot of squabbling going on about who has the right to do what. Somebody we know wrote and said, could you please give me a lottery number for next week?
You should point out that you finished this before the current pandemic, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We have a son-in-law at the Harvard School of Public Health whose professional life now for two decades has been spent worrying about pandemics. It's like earthquakes. We were aware for a long time that a pandemic will happen. The only thing that is unknown is what particular form it will take and when it will happen. But this is not the equivalent of an invasion from outer space. This is something that professionals have been worried about for years.
The term paper amendment, you spoke about that. Since then, another state has ratified the ERA, but it has not gone into effect. So what's the difference between the term paper amendment and the ERA?
Well, the term paper amendment had to do with Congress not being able to vote itself raises that would take effect during the session that those particular Congress people were in office. And initially, that amendment came up, what, Sandy, in the 18th century?
Oh, yeah, 1791.
Right.
Oh, actually, 1789 was when it was proposed. But at that point, there were no time limits. The first time that an amendment was proposed with a time limit was actually the Prohibition Amendment, the 18th Amendment in 1918, I think it was. So the UT student, University of Texas student, Gregory Watkins, is that right, noticed that there was not a time limit and wrote in his term paper that that meant it was still on the table, and wouldn't it be neat if it were ratified in the late in the 20th century? As we point out, he got a C for his
initially,
paper because it just seemed wacky. But he ended up being altogether prescient And there was a ceremony several years ago in which his grade was changed to an A+.
But the ERA did have an exploding timeline attached to it.
Right.
Well, so it's not clear if there will be a sufficient number of states. I mean, there may well be a sufficient number of states under the old rules, but those old rules may be obsolete.
Yeah. From my perspective, it's interesting as a bit of political theater, but I think this is one of the many things about the Constitution that will generate lawyers yelling at one another about whether this is really legitimate or not. I have no idea what the answer will turn out to be.
This is actually a pretty good way of studying American history, doing it through the ins and outs of the Constitution, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, some of it is what has been changed, the good news. The original Constitution can accurately be described, I think, as pro-slavery, and the 13th Amendment got rid of that, at least as a formal matter. But there's also the reality that a lot of the Constitution seems impervious to change because of the sheer difficulty of constitutional amendment. At this moment, I happen to be working on a review of three books on the Electoral College, a topic of some interest today. And one of the themes of all of the books is that there has been opposition to the Electoral College since 1816, and every public opinion poll taken by Gallup since 1944 has shown that a majority of the American public would get rid of the Electoral College, but we still have it. And that is a testament to the sheer difficulty of constitutional change, and that's really something people should understand.
I think it's very ironic that you said a majority of the people want to get rid of the Electoral College, but they can't. It's
right. Yep, that's absolutely right.
Well, and it's really a paradox about our governmental system in many ways altogether. Many people would also like to get rid of the Senate's ability to filibuster, but that doesn't happen. It kind of never goes away.
When you were putting this book together, you said there's less text. You couldn't really put as much in as you did the others. How did you decide which parts of this story needed to be in here?
Well, to some extent, we relied on the expertise of the illustrator, Ali Schwed, and our editor, Mark Siegel. We figured that they had the best sense of what would be the best blend of text and illustration. So although a fair amount of the text from the original version of the book is not in here, the gist of a lot of it is still there because it's conveyed in the pictures. For a while, I wondered about the idea of calling it a graphic novel because it's a nonfiction book. On the other hand, there are indications of people, say George Washington, saying things that they never really said, which of course we would not do in a nonfiction book in a text format. But to the extent that there is fabricated dialogue to give it kind of punch, in that sense there are fictional aspects to it. And to some extent those take the place of the completely accurate, and footnoted and cited text passages that we have in the original book. So many of those decisions were made by those who are experts in comic books.
There is an awful lot, as you mentioned, about the Electoral College. That actually kind of explains it really well. Also a lot about elections, too. So, and that's, I imagine that's going to get a lot of attention coming up in the next 60 days or so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. We are particularly fond, in fact, of some of the illustrations regarding elections and the Electoral College. Both of those, as well as the chapters that deal with representation, say in the House of Representatives and especially in the Senate, include a fair amount of math. And Ali was really able to convey that math in graphic formats quite well. Yeah, there's a page here, get ready for some math, with a balance scale with states on it of different sizes and candidates holding up cheerleading flags. As I say, some of the text is gone, but a lot of the meaning is there. So we think that a lot of this information about the election and what might seem complicated about the Electoral College is really laid out in a very appealing format.
One of the historic quotes that you highlight in the book had to do with how old someone needed to be elected president. And it said, old enough for voters to judge their true character. There's nothing vague about that, is there?
Yeah.
It sounds plausible that that would have been a reason given at the convention for requiring that presidents be 35, whereas senators only need to be 30 or representatives 25, that you have the additional 10 years to see their actual character.
You know, I'm remembering this now. John Jay did say that. I don't remember where he was or in what format he said that.
He wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, so he would have said it sometime else. And, you know, he might even have said it during the 1800 election, because as anybody who has ever even listened to, let alone seen, Hamilton now knows, Hamilton ended up endorsing Jefferson over Burr, because although he despised Jefferson on political grounds, he had a certain regard for Jefferson's character, and Hamilton thought that Burr was simply an unscrupulous scoundrel and nothing more. That is why he endorsed Jefferson. You know, that certainly contributed, no doubt, to Burr's ultimately challenged him to a duel and killing him in 1804.
And of course, now with this upcoming election, we certainly have two men of sufficient age stature that people should be aware of their character.
Right. Whatever the problem is with this election, it's not that youngsters are trying to put something over on us.
Still to come, we'll talk a little more about the fault lines in the Constitution, including a fact about some presidents who tried for a third term but didn't quite make it. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guests today are Cynthia Levinson, a writer of nonfiction for young adults, and Sandy Levinson, a professor of law at the University of Texas in Austin. We're talking about the new edition of their book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, the graphic novel. One fact I didn't know was that before FDR won his third term in office, there were two other presidents who gave a third term a less than successful try.
Right, though neither of them did it consecutively.
Teddy was one, is that right?
Teddy was one, but you know, he took off 1908 to 1912 before running again. And I think we might have mentioned that Ulysses Grant was tempted to run, I think, in 1880. But nobody in office ran for a third term until FDR. Now, it's also the case, actually, that I don't remember whether we mentioned this, because this really is kind of inside baseball, that Woodrow Wilson, even though he was almost completely incapacitated because of a stroke, was also something of a megalomaniac. And in 1920, he actually had fantasies of running for a third term. But they were not taken seriously. That was his own megalomania. It's not that anybody said this would be a good idea.
So you do grade the Constitution in this book, and it actually kind of looks like the grades I had in school. Why so low?
Well, we kind of explain it, we think. We have a rubric, as teachers, you know, educators out there will know what a rubric is. You have to have standards for giving a student or a constitution a grade. And I think it was Sandy's brilliant idea to use the preamble to the Constitution as the rubric. So we explain what the framers meant by forming a more perfect union, establishing justice, promoting general welfare, that sort of thing. We invite readers to interpret and analyze and update what they think those terms should mean. But in terms of our meaning of it, we think the Constitution is not meeting its intentions very well.
And if truth be known, I would give the Constitution a lower grade today than even in 2019, when our second edition came out, because I do believe that it is now crystal clear that impeachment does not work as a mechanism for holding presidents accountable. That if you put the Clinton impeachment together with the Trump impeachment, given a polarized political system, it is fanciful to think that a president would be bounced. I believe that is a truly serious defect in the Constitution.
And we confess that we are both chagrined that we do not include a chapter on impeachment in the book. But we have blogged about it. We blog updates to the book every month at faultlinesintheconstitution.com. And the August blog post, by the way, is about whether or not people, once there is a vaccine for COVID-19, whether or not people will be required or forced to receive it. That is a constitutional issue.
So you're not talking about any controversial topics then?
Never.
I think we've determined, if nothing else, that there is no penalty for going against the Emoluments Clause.
Right. That was simply dismissed by almost everybody except a few lawyers who were then described with some degree of accuracy as partisans. There was, in fact, one Republican, a person who had been in George Bush's White House as a chief ethics officer, who was furious about the Emoluments Clause. But he really is more described as a former Republican, certainly a never-Trumper. And the issue just went away. It's as if it doesn't exist.
Right. Well, finally, before we started recording, I made a joke saying that, you know, you've done Fault Lines from the Constitution. You've done the paperback edition. Now you have the graphic novel. What's next? The Broadway musical. But you tell me, it's already been on Broadway.
Well, Heidi Schreck wrote and performed in a play called What the Constitution Means to Me. She came to a presentation that Sandy and I did when the first version of the book came out in 2017 for New York area teachers about fault lines. And she was so taken with our arguments and presentations in the book that she based part of the play on a debate that we have in the book about whether or not there should be another constitutional convention, the ways that the Constitution can or should be changed. She phrased it somewhat differently. In fact, the play was on Broadway, but it has gone on the road, and I think once theaters open up again, I know, in fact, that it will be replayed. And Sandy and I were able to do a talk back after one of the performances of the play on Broadway. Not something that children's writers or constitutional law scholars often think about, but it was a thrill, and we were grateful to her, and Heidi wrote a terrific endorsement of the book.
Again, the name of Cynthia Levinson and Professor Sandy Levinson's new book is Fault Lines in the Constitution, the graphic novel. It's illustrated by Ali Schwed. It's been 34 years, but Hollywood's most recognizable fighter pilot, Pete Maverick Mitchell, will be back in the cockpit for the new Top Gun movie. Navy leaders say the original Tom Cruise film led to a recruiting surge, but it's not clear whether next year's sequel will have the same effect. From Los Angeles, Libby Denkman reports for the American Homefront Project.
That's my Top Gun diploma over there. John Semkin was a Navy lieutenant, a fighter pilot, and a graduate of the Navy Fighter Weapons School's Top Gun program back in 1985, when his boss, the Rear Admiral in charge of Air Station Miramar, dropped, of all things, a movie script on his desk.
None of us wanted to do it. We were pilots. We didn't want to take over working on a movie, right?
But Semkin was outranked, so he became a technical advisor on the Top Gun set, teaching Hollywood actors how to be fighter pilots. Or at least look the part.
I'll bring you to me closer, Merlin.
You're gonna do what?
Like in the climactic dogfight at the end of the movie when Iceman and Maverick are doing some tricky flying to outmaneuver enemy MiGs.
This is it, Maverick.
I'm gonna hit the brakes, he'll fly right by.
And that's when Tom Cruise says, John, he says, yeah. How do they know I'm pulling G's, you know? And I said, well, you got to tighten all your muscles because you're trying to keep the blood in your head.
Semkin says seeing his work up on the big screen gave him a lot of pride. For the Navy, Top Gun served another purpose.
It was the best recruiting movie that you've ever seen.
Commander Ronald Flanders is the spokesperson for U.S. Naval Air Forces.
If you talk to a lot of the senior pilots in the Navy today, the captains and admirals, many of them attribute their interest in naval aviation to the original release of that film.
The original Top Gun triggered a military recruiting boom, according to contemporary news reports. Movie theaters in Los Angeles and Detroit invited recruiting officers to set up tables in their lobbies to talk with moviegoers with stars and F-14s in their eyes. And this kind of synergy between Hollywood and the armed forces is by design. Each military service branch has a liaison office in Los Angeles that works with film and television producers. Lieutenant Colonel Brett Lee is the deputy director of the Army's Public Affairs Office in L.A.
It doesn't matter if they're fighting, like, you know, alien robots or they are discussing their job as a Black Hawk helicopter mechanic. We want to see positive, accurate representations of what they do.
With scripted productions like Top Gun, the Pentagon reviews the story and negotiates with the production company over whether the military will participate. The Top Gun Maverick crew was given access to 2 aircraft carriers and multiple Navy bases and installations. Actors got special training. The Navy says Paramount Pictures paid for all flight hours for aerial sequences. Why go to all this trouble? The film audience is made up of American taxpayers and potential service members.
The depiction of a young Army soldier in a film is going to be much more profound than, say, even a 30-second commercial that we are producing.
But it's a different world now, says Carl Forsling, who flew helicopters and tilt-rotor aircraft like the V-22 Osprey in the Marine Corps. Yep, Tom Cruise got to him, too.
I remember when I was in 8th grade and I saw that movie, that's, you know, I immediately wanted to be a pilot.
Forsling says this time around, the new Top Gun won't have the same juice at recruiting offices as the original. He wrote an op-ed in Task and Purpose on the subject, arguing it's all about context. In 86, the Vietnam War had been over for almost a dozen years. Young people who were recruiting age didn't have it as a touchstone. Ronald Reagan's Morning in America was in full effect.
I think people were receptive to it. They had no direct observation of a war in progress to compare the movie-ready theatrics to.
Today, the war in Afghanistan has been dragging on longer than many recruits have been alive.
It's combat on the ground, and most of the aviation fighting is either providing, you know, eyes in the sky or occasionally dropping bombs on target, but very little of it's the glamorous air warfare you see in Top Gun.
The Pentagon will have a while to wait. Paramount Pictures planned to release the sequel this summer, but the studio says it's committed to a theatrical release that's now scheduled for July 2021. In Los Angeles, I'm Libby Denkman.
So many of us have been stuck at home for the last few months, we've almost forgotten the joys of travel. Ah, travel. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How does travel affect you? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, James Petrick, professor in the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Sciences, explores cruise participants' experiences to find out.
Understanding the physiological and psychological effects of travel is believed to be important as it could dramatically affect how and why people travel. Thus, the research's primary purpose was to determine how different activities on a vacation affect both the perceived and observed stress of cruise travelers. Secondary purposes included the identification of how situational factors affect these relationships. while psychometric analyses have suggested travel has the ability to relieve stress and improve one's overall well-being, it is believed the current research is the first to utilize physiological data to examine the effects of travel on health. The research was guided by the cognitive activation theory of stress and compared self-reported diaries and physiological data using heart rate monitors to examine the effects a 7-day cruise had on participants' perceived and actual stress. Theoretically, the results suggest that CATS is an excellent conceptual framework for understanding both perceived and observed stress of travelers. As per the theory, it was found that stress stimuli, in this case activities, had an effect on both perceived stress appraisals and physiological stress responses measured with heart rate monitors. Additionally, situational variables including crowdedness, excitement, leisure, and novelty were found to be related to these effects. Likely most importantly, it was found that even though perceptions of stress tended to linger for a little while, observed stress was found to return to normal even after the most stressful of events on a vacation. This suggests that participants' hearts were healthier at the end of their 7-day cruise vacation.
That was James Petrick of Texas A&M University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.